Is anybody else joining us on stage? No? On stage?
Scott?
Okay. Scott, you coming? Now, you know it's a packed house when you run out of chairs for the actual presenters. Like, Amy Goodman's still doing outreach in the crowd, though, so, you know, it's like, I think it'll be all right. My name is Max. I'm the development director here at the Brecht Forum. I'd like to welcome you all, on behalf of the Brecht Forum, to an evening with Grace Lee Boggs, Ruby Dee, and many others, many of our friends up here tonight. Just want to join me in just quickly welcoming everybody. I'd also just like to quickly acknowledge my coworker Kazimbe in the back, who's put a lot of work. As well as all of our interns and volunteers and everybody who makes this place well. Thank you very much. So the Brecht Forum this year, we are celebrating our 36th year anniversary. And thank you. I know it's gonna be a lot of clapping tonight. No more clapping. But we are excited to be celebrating our 36th year anniversary, and we're really excited in our 36th year. You know, a lot of institutions after a few years, you kind of like, they kind of slowly start going downhill, but we're really glad. You know, we moved into the space 6 years ago, and we were like, man, we're gonna have to fill this space every single night. And it's been really nice to see such a positive, you know, warm, welcome response from all of you. And night in, night out, you know, we've been so lucky to not only feature, you know, some amazing speakers like Grace, who travel from all over the country, but also really to have all of you here to share in these conversations that, especially right now, of course, we know are so, so critical. So, you know, all I'll really say about the Brecht Forum before I pitch two quick events is that you can find out all of our events online on our website at www.brechtforum.org. And also, if you so happen to be inspired to do so, I urge everybody to become a Brecht Forum subscriber. For as little as $15. You know, I think it's the same, like the guy that sells the chopping thing with the onions, like late at night on TV. I think for the price of one of those things, right, you can support your favorite neighborhood community political institution here at the Brecht Forum. So I really, you know, I really encourage all of you to do that, and you can sign up on our website, brechtforum.org. I'm gonna plug two quick events. It's a crazy spring this spring. The first one is next Thursday evening, Thursday, April 21st, we're actually going to be very, very lucky to be joined by Vandana Shiva, who's going to be coming all the way from India, and she's going to be in dialogue with David Harvey and some other friends of ours at the CUNY Graduate Center. Next Thursday, April 21st at 6:30 p.m., tickets will sell out, so please do visit the website. It's a larger space than this, but still get your tickets online. And then a very large event that we have coming up with Miss Angela Davis. It's going to be a Friday evening in May, Friday, May 20th. And that's going to be up at Riverside Church, where we do a series of programs each year with the Social Justice Ministry up there in Harlem. So please consider coming to that event as well. It should be a lot of fun. And now I'm going to turn the mic over to one of my favorite actresses of all time, Ruby Dee. Award-winning actress. Do the Right Thing. Come on, there's not a better movie ever than Do the Right Thing. Best movie ever made. And please, Ruby, thank you so much for being here tonight. We're really excited.
Short people always feel a sense of their sitting down. I have legs and everything. I'm very happy to be here at this celebration of the Brecht Forum, and to be here with my more than my good friend, my relative, my kinsman, my what can I tell you? She Grace Boggs and her husband Jimmy have been crucial and critical to our lives, and especially to mine, because I didn't even know I had a brain, really, until in certain areas and in certain ways, until I started hanging out with these people. I went, as best I could, and going up to the think tanks up in Maine. Conversations in Maine really changed my mind, because I was so impressed with what conversations mean to a society, to a community, to a life, to everything that we do, that we the way we understand each other, the way countries make it is through conversation. I'm so accustomed to Ossie, my husband, being the first speaker. Yeah. But I've learned, and I can talk too, you know. So. and especially when I'm encouraged and invited to a place like at the Breck Forum to speak, because there is so much to say. This place stands for so much that is vital to all our lives, and I just like to. To read something I wrote about Jimmy after he died. I say Jimmy because I feel as if he were my brother. I would also say my brother, that's very, very close. I can't say my child because he was a little bit older than I am. And I'm feeling that close to him, and as if Grace were my sister. These people, and I remember carefully, I remember deep, sharply, sitting in living rooms, listening to Freddie and Grace, all those people who were connected with and Ossie, and we'll talk about all of that, and going through some of those conversations that led to conversations in Maine, and how awestruck I felt to feel that so much of what I was thinking and had not yet articulated, because I didn't know how, that they were talking and I was beginning to hear things and understand far more deeply than I ever had. And so, when Jimmy passed on, and since that time, I've ceased to believe in death, because, you know, there's no such thing. And when we can talk about Jimmy, and we can remember people like Jimmy, we understand that the essence of life continues, you know, that the leaf on the tree never dies, it just becomes something else, and it becomes part of something else. And so although I wrote this long time ago, and today before I came, I almost started writing it over again, and I said, no, that won't do, you know, because I'm thinking better thoughts now. But I found myself making notes, but I'm not going to rewrite it here before you now. because I said, dear Jimmy, dear James E. Boggs, there has been no, I have met few people in my life who impressed me as this man. As this man does and has. I'd not met him as a person, and I hadn't really known what independent thinking was all about until I met James E. Boggs, until I met his wife Grace, until I hung out with like minds. And I was listening mostly, but I wrote this. It seems amateurish now, Like, I'm going to do a little bit more. But I said, dear James, E. Boggs. And Babbitt exists such a place as this. So you can just talk about things. As I think of you, I get a feeling of three names, three pronouncements. So I'm inserting an E to rhyme with Lee, as in Grace Lee, because as I think of you, my mind turns from two to trinities. Pyramid turns to pyramids from you would like me to speak louder? Oh, okay. From pyramids to ancient secrets, rituals, to three immovable points of light, encompassing the all-seeing eye when eternities yawn. They metamorphize from circles and they metamorphize from circles and they become pyramids. Maybe, despite all our protestations of not now, too soon, so much left undone, etc. That's what death is all about. Eternities on burnout with hangover, in recess, taking a nap, Father, Son, Holy Ghost, Mother, I'm moving out, midnight, morning, noon, and night. Are you shrugging your shoulders? I'm talking to James now because I was so impressed with those worker hands of his. Are you shrugging your shoulders, worker hands outstretched from arms, elbows pressed to sides, eyes wide, proclaiming, we all got to die. That's a given. Nothing we can do about that. Let's spend our time doing, saying something that can make a difference. That makes sense. It's logical. Well, I see, I don't expect to win a prize for stoic control and dignity at morning time. Death deserves tantrums. Beating back, shocked, indignation, kicks in the groin, stones classified unacceptable, not to be tolerated, not to be woo, not to be conspired with. Only then can music, dance, movies, plays, rap be about life. Only then can life be cherished and adored and made the main ingredient of existence. I'm through with gallantry and death. No more of that. No more of that about death. Let the awards come for the living gallantry day by day. Death needs to be backgrounded, needs not to be confused with the main event. You, dear James, you and Grace represent the nobleness of life. Stalwart cheerleaders of the Better Way contingent. water on the seabed of exciting and necessary choices. You, Grace, and Jimmy, you have certainly opened us, Ossie and me, to horizons of thought and theory that underline and strengthen so much of what we have done and hope to do in our remaining minutes in the arts. In the life, you have taught us ways of thinking and looking at life and its challenges that without you may have escaped us. So, even though I cry and want to tear out what's left of the hair I have, as I think of you trying to ease out of the door unnoticed, but dazzling, and stopping us all with the enormous body of thought and instructions for future directions flying toward us. My heart reaches through the event to hold and hug you hard and swear and cry before you smiling with fingers and lips, quietly close the door. So when you move through the glory tunnel, my heart will track the journey with you, shouting, love, love, love. We truly love you. Best we so far know how. And if you won't be too busy, come see us sometime. And I wrote another kind of ending, but I don't know what I did. come see us sometime. If you can, and oh yeah. But I have to share what I tried to write. If you can, come visit us from time to time and help us plot the course for some really out of sight, incredible stops forward on the journey toward eternal greatness as a species in the foreverness of love in a place called Earth. You got it?
This morning, I didn't think I would be following that. That's something I imagined. Thank you so much for so being here. My name's Angela, and I first met Grace when I was 13. It was at the perfect ripe age where you're ready to see the world in a different sort of way. It was perfect, you know? And I was part of a youth organization that Grace helped to found. You know, we did gardening and we did murals and we did all those fun things that really engages young people. But we also reflected upon what was going on in our lives and by extension in the world. That time in my life, the 10 years in which I was part of that organization, my mind was stimulated. I was nurtured intellectually, but I was also nurtured emotionally. It was not just the head, right? It was also the heart, and it was exactly what young people need. And it was such a gift to be a part of that organization. And so I'm really grateful for that. But what came out of that was this need to express what I was learning and what I was observing and what I was feeling. And I could only do that through art, which is interesting. And so I think that is pretty it's pretty telling that there are a lot of artists here in this room and on the stage right now, and there are poets and actors and musicians, and I think that the way that we make change is creatively, right? And by creating works of art is how we sort of communicate that to the world. So with that, I thought I would share a little poem that I wrote while I was a very young person in that organization. Mm-hmm. Keep that in mind, please. yes, and Grace always makes me read it. because she likes it, which is awesome. But it's called Dig, it's a culmination of everything. It encompasses everything that I got out of that time in my life. So here goes. They're forgotten shoes in this soil, and I'm gonna dig for them. Don't give me those tools that my brothers used to extract diamonds from a land that they once called home. No, I'm gonna use my hands. I'll scar the ground and scrape the stones in desperation, digging for a truth that is buried down deep, buried with a purpose. I'll scratch with my nails and punch with my fists, shaking the earth with the urgent blows until I hit some solid surface. The surface of a revelation so true is too true to bear witness to. These violent secrets unveiled, dirty like the dust on my knuckles that are angry and clenched in a fretful pose. This earth is not a lake where I can dip palms in and let drops drip from my fingertips. No, these secrets are too painful, and the earth is unwilling, so I will make my hands of metal, digging through the cracks and meant to excavate skyscrapers, finding tombs of wounds that bear the fruit of privilege, elite, and moth-eaten purple pinstripe. My destiny is to dig for doubtless truth, shattering dogmas with jackhammers and finding jailhouse files in my raised fist, to file away the bars of steel mines and copper mines, freeing ancestors of mine and yours from slavery, indentured servitude, and minimum wage. This earth that hides the headlines and hellraisers of old revolutions is that same earth that bore me into a kingdom of corrupt kings and cruel intentions. This institution is not amorous. It knows its sins. Now I shall know them too. This dirt is soaked with nuclear test sites, ghetto mounds of brass-covered garbage, or children run through mutated weeds. This dirt is carried on the wind, gets in your eyes, and blinds you from the internment camps that were once there. In this soil rest the sullen graves of adobe huts, and in their place were reservation hut houses and welfare cheese, barrio booze, and CIA-sold street crystals all picked from the same genetically modified tree growing in the closet we hide our skeletons in. The deep, dark depths of the earth hide the secrets to shame and bad decisions. What's fair is often forgotten, and you can't find freedom from a flag. You have to dig for it.
Yes.
So dig for your freedom, fragile figures of history's failures, or I'll dig for you. For those fools of fortune out plowed through the lies and muck of middlework and their intern stock shares into plowshares, giving campesinos back their polycultural crops. I will worm my way through the holes in this planet to other kingdoms and freedoms forgotten, because this earth is not rotten. It cleanses itself, every other empire, by hands that dig for the truth. Through old tragedies and fallen legacies, we must keep the past in mind and at hand to seize that chance to begin anew. Dig.
Now I gotta go after both of those. I'm gonna try to keep this short, and there's a lot to say, but that just made me think. I'm from Detroit, also. My name is Julie Rozier, and that made me think that I missed out on Detroit summer. I didn't know about it when I was 13, but I did meet Grace as a senior in college at the University of Michigan, where she was speaking on a panel of women activists, and after the Q&A, I raised my little hand because I was trying to figure out what career path I could take, and I said, how do you become an activist? And they said, like, get an internship at a nonprofit. And that didn't sound so good to me. I did not have Detroit Summer, but I had Mosaic Youth Theater of Detroit. And I had learned about the bonds that form when people create art together, when young people create art together out of hardly anything, and hardly any money. And so I knew that that was something that I wanted, but it was so deep packed back there in the shadows that I didn't think that I could get to it. But my sister for my graduation present gave me Living for Change, Grace Lee Boggs' autobiography. And I started reading a story of a Shiro. And I started finding other Shiros around me. And I also was reading a book right around the same time, 2 years out of college, called The Power of Myth. And I started seeing and hearing that there were these heroes and Shiros that had been around for all of humanity. And I saw myself in Grace's story, and I saw that I could combine exactly what it was that I saw as the thing to do in order to create the change that I saw could come. And I thought of a way to combine theater and social change by bringing people together to tell their own stories and to find that thread that connects every human being to every other, and that thread that is so specific to yourself, that thread of passion that can pull you towards your goal, your mission. And it pulled me towards Grace. Shortly after, a few years later, I ended up living at the Boggs Center with Grace so that I could launch this theater company that had no money and I had no time because I was trying to survive with nonprofit jobs and waiting tables and all the things that I needed to do. But when I was at one of the first months that I was at the Boggs Center, Grace sat me down with a DVD of Angela's poetry, and she said, you have to watch this. And I was remembering myself bawling, crying, listening to that big poem. poem. Seeing another Shiro who came from Detroit, who is creating this as a young teenager. And I said, you know, I'm 27, 28 at that point. I'm just getting started. I can do this. And so I did, but it took me underground. It took me to that place that the force of antagonism, once you start off on that path, is so great. And Grace and Hegel call it the labor suffer and the labor. Come on, help me, Grace. The labor, the patience, and the suffering of the negative. And I thought, oh wait, I know about that from drama, right? Isn't it always about the conflict and the obstacles? And doesn't that push you? Doesn't that make your character come forward and take you to the next level? And but it still sucks, and it feels like death. It feels like death. But I produced my first theater project there at the Bog Center, and this year I'm back in New York and I'm producing the second round. And this play is called Facing the Minotaur, which comes from a myth story where Theseus sets out to go enter the labyrinth where there is a Minotaur, this shadow, this face of the negative, this little hater that lives inside each of us. And he's going in, and Ariadne sees him, and she falls in love with him, and she says, you're not going to survive unless you have this, a ball of red thread. And that when you take it in, tie it to the entrance, go in there, kill that Minotaur, and then find your way out with this thread. And so I'm in the midst of it right now. I'm definitely in the labyrinth. I don't know if we killed the Minotaur or not, but we're definitely looking at the shadows in our lives. The ensemble that I'm working with is using their own stories, and we're creating this together. And I know that eventually we'll come to the other side. We will return following that thread of passion. And we will see what happens when you can see people become 50 times grander than they thought they could be. You'll see what happens when you go through that struggle and your soul is able to grow as a result. And all of the teachers that are showing me the way, that are standing there pushing me along, of all of them, Grace has been tremendously impactful to me, and I love her dearly.
Bandelli, and I'm just really excited to be here. I'm happy to be in the company of Grace once again, in the company of Ruby D, and others here whose, you know, names I might not know, whose individual stories I might not know, but, you know, are impactful nonetheless. I want to say that people my age, I'm 34, and people my age and younger, I think, you know, didn't really have the benefit of having lived at the height of the movement in the way that Grace did, and, you know, others in this room probably did. We have no idea what it's like to attend an event and hear somebody like Jimmy Bobbs just tell plain truth in the way that he did. Or we couldn't, you know, just walk up on a rally and hear Malcolm X speaking. We couldn't join groups like correspondence and, you know, publish papers and things like that in the way that they could do at the height of the movement. And for us, a lot of times we come across politics like these revolutionary politics, radical politics. We come across them sometimes by accident or by chance. And we find ourselves just trying to navigate a lot of the, you know, just the kind of ideological turmoil and chaos that has kind of gripped the movement since the height that we saw, you know, 40 or 50 years ago. So I just want to say that I was introduced to Jimmy and Gracie's politics really quite by accident a few years ago. My husband and I, we were a part of a study group that was meeting in Philadelphia. And a guy in the study group, our older brother, he gave us a copy of the Manifesto for a Black Revolutionary Party. And I can just say that our lives haven't been the same since. Just reading it, and I think for people in this room, you can probably relate to when you get your hands on something that's, you know, just so engaging, so interesting, just, you know, just telling the truth. It's almost like striking gold or hitting the lottery or something like that. And that's what that experience was like for me and for my husband, just, you know, coming across these ideas that we had never seen put out in that way. When you look at the manifesto where they're explaining the difference between rebellion and revolution and critiquing movement practices, things like that. Talking about the personal responsibility that people, if you're struggling under the banner of revolution, is personal. These are the personal responsibilities that you must take. In addition, we looked at him and we looked at her laying out exactly what Black Power meant. You know, in that manifesto there, he's saying, this is what Black Power is. This is what Black Power looks like. And if we're going to bring it about, this is the kind of responsibility that each one of us is going to have to take on an individual level. So that was something that, you know, initially when I first came in contact with their ideas, it was something that was really, really striking to me. And I just want to read a quote really fast. This is something that one of many, of course, obviously, anybody who knows their ideas knows that. But, you know, this is a quote that I have on my Facebook page right now. I have it in my classroom where I teach high school. And my students, they might not understand the full impact, but it's there. And so just really quickly, it says, revolutionary struggle for power requires less rhetoric and more calculation. It requires a different kind of organization with a different, more scientific ideology. Different, more strategically developed programs for escalating struggles. Different, more carefully worked out structures to implement these programs. Different, less flamboyant leadership. Different, more disciplined and committed members who are so convinced of the need for Black revolutionary power that the concept could be erased from their minds only by death itself. And so those are the kinds of things that, you know, I associate with them. Those are the kinds of things that, you know, we were just really struck by when we first came in contact. So after that first, you know, when we got our hands on the manifesto for a Black Revolutionary Party, we read Revolution and Evolution. We read Awesome Responsibilities, Pages from a Negro Worker's Notebook, just everything that I could get my hands on. And it really changed the way that I view political struggle in general. I think that, you know, their analysis, when you compare it to other things that was written, you know, at the height of the movement, their analysis is so sharp. It's so sober. It's profound, but it's also very, very simple. And I really appreciated the way that they made concepts that you see other thinkers do somersaults with. They made it so plain and just so very simple. Like when you take, for instance, their ideas about the primary contradiction in this country right now, they talk about it being material abundance alongside political underdevelopment, material overdevelopment alongside political underdevelopment. And that's a fairly simple statement, but just think about how much truth it contains. And, you know, think about how much our daily lives and our how much of our daily lives and our daily experiences it really explains. Well, when they talk about becoming a more human being, again, a very, very simple statement, but just think of the profound truth that it contains. So by the time I had read Living for Change, I decided that I wanted to write my master's thesis on Grace and Jimmy's ideas. And I was lucky enough to have a professor who knew Grace and who had worked with her closely, you know, years ago. And he set it up for me to travel to Detroit and stay there at the Box Center and spend some time with her. And I'm just so grateful for that opportunity that I had. Now, that was about 5 years ago, 6 years ago. But before I wrap up, I just want to talk briefly about a couple of things that really, really struck me during the time that I stayed there in Detroit with Grace. One thing was just the pace that she kept. Mm-hmm. It was just unbelievable. I was only there for about 4 days. And in those 4 days, I mean, it was rallies. We were planting trees. We went to and then we marched down the street. It was bands playing. They had like children from Detroit Summer, you know, things. It was a band. We had forums. It was a forum going on. So you had all of that activity, and then after that, we would go back to Grace, to the Box Center, and it would be an informal gathering. And it might be, you know, Rick Feldman was there, Steve Ward, people like that, that just, you know, gravitate to her and just come and sit around and talk. So, you know, we had that activity. And then, you know, Grace, you know, she took a personal interest in what I was writing about. So after all of that, you know, she'll hand me books that she wants me to read. She'll hand me a stack of articles, you know, that she wants me to go through. So, you know, I was just really struck by the pace and the amount of activity that, you know, was going on there that she was involved in. In addition to that, it was also just how sharp Grace was. I was just, you know, I couldn't believe. She, you know, discussed revolutionary politics and Marxism just like people discuss the weather. It was just amazing. And so it was just more than an honor for me to be asked to come here, you know, about Grace and about Grace and Jimmy's legacy. And, you know, their story, it needs to be told. Their ideas need to be grappled with and reckoned with. And, you know, just their life example, it needs to be, everybody needs to know about it. And I'm just happy to be a part of people who recognize what she has done, what her husband, her late husband did, and just, you know, are trying to do justice to their legacy.
Yes.
So, thank you.
Honor it is to be here with Ruby D, with these remarkable young people, with Grace Lee Boggs and with Scott Kurashige, and to talk about, well, the title of their book is pretty much what we're going to be talking about, The Next American Revolution.
So,
so, Grace, how would you describe the next American Revolution?
I think the next American Revolution, from the response we've been getting since the book was published, is what the American people are looking for. I think we are in the place, at a time in the clock of the world, where we know that we have to make some very fundamental changes, that we have the power within us to make those changes, and that if we only name it and begin thinking about the power that we have to create something new, to take humanity to a next stage of evolution, that we can do it, and it will be something that the whole world is looking for, because they're looking for change in this country. It's something that Americans are looking for, because we know that the empire is dying. It's something that I think that all of the world wants us to do, that we have so long been exploiting the rest of the world. We have achieved our comforts and conveniences at the expense of the earth and of other peoples, and that we have to change, and that our change will be a blessing to the world. And I think that's why there's a resonance to that title, The Next American Revolution. Think about it. Think about it. Think about it. not like the old revolution about, like, in terms of taking hold of the state and exercising power over other people, or increasing the amount of abundance that we have, material abundance, or creating more nuclear reactors, but as something that's the evolution of our humanity, and that the time has come for that. I think people are feeling that.
Scott, you wrote this book together. So talk about how you came to know Grace and what this relationship has been over the years.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us, Amy. Thank you for having Grace on the show yesterday. I think Democracy Now, you guys are all familiar with the show, but I think it's played such a major role in bringing Grace's voice, which is absolutely essential to what's going on in Detroit, but bringing that voice of Detroit and other Detroiters really to a much wider audience that's national and international. So I really want to thank Amy for all the work you've done and your whole crew. My pleasure to you. I met Grace in 1998. At that time, I had been in graduate school for a while, and I had been a community activist, you know, for basically my whole adult life. And I had decided that I was going to be a radical because the things that I had experienced growing up as a person of color, the things I had witnessed in terms of wars and in terms of the inequalities and injustices that happened in society required substantial, dramatic, revolutionary change. But I had never really thought much about the power of ideas and how it's not enough to simply declare that you're against capitalism and racism and imperialism and war and poverty. That we need to think, as Grace does, philosophically, about what we're doing as people to make a difference, about how we're not just against things, but how we need to be for something. And very, very simple concepts, which oftentimes elude people who've even been in the struggle for a long time, because we see so much right in front of us that we have to fight against, that we have to agitate against, that we have to denounce and oppose. And that Grace would talk about the need to think about the means that we're using to create change. Because every time we're organizing and every time we're struggling, we're not just opposing something. We're actually creating a new way of relating to people. We're creating a new model of the society that we want to live through. And this is something that Grace has done for 7 decades. I mean, I don't know if there are many other people left who started their activism at the end of the Great Depression. So it's just a great fortune and an honor for me to be able to learn from all of that experience and to learn from all of that history. And I think it's just so important that it goes through the struggles with C.L.R. James and through the Black Power Movement and her work with Jimmy Boggs, and to see Detroit go from one of the world's wealthiest cities to one of the world's most abandoned and dissed cities anywhere. So I'll just stop there and just say it really caused me to think differently and not just to be someone who's only acting.
So you talked about Grace's activism going back 70 years. I would guess it's really longer than that, being that you're 95 now, Grace. And it's wonderful to be here with you. What a role model you are for carrying on. Especially for young people or people who are brought by friends who don't yet know you, talk about your history. Talk about where you were born, where your parents were born, and how you wound up in Detroit.
Well, my parents came from China in the first 1911, as a matter of fact. And my mother never learned how to read and write because she was brought up in a little Chinese village where there were no schools for females. And I was born on top of my father's Chinese restaurant. And when I cried, the waiters used to say, just leave her on the hillside. She's only a girl baby. And that taught me very early on that we needed changes in this world. And I attribute my activism actually to that time. But it wasn't until I got a doctorate in philosophy in 1940. And the idea of a woman, a Chinese woman particularly, getting a job in the teaching in the university was so outlandish. I mean, the Macy's would come out and say, we don't hire Orientals. Then I went to Chicago and I found a job for $10 a week in the philosophy library. And a lot of people didn't make more than $500 a year in 1940. But it wasn't very much money still. So I found a place where I could stay rent-free in the basement. And the only obstacle was that I had to face down rats in order to get into the basement from the back alley. And that made me very rat conscious. So I made connections with a group of Chicago people who were struggling against rat infested housing, and of course they were black. And that was my first contact really with the black community. And that brought me into contact with the March on Washington movement led by A. Philip Randolph in 1941. In 1941, the Depression had ended for white workers, but not for blacks, because the defense plants were booming, but they didn't hire blacks. And Randolph began to mobilize blacks all over the country to march on Washington. And FDR was so afraid that image of blacks marching against racism would go all over the world when he was preparing for a war against Hitler, that he issued Executive Order 8802 banning discrimination in defense plants, and that gave blacks for the first time an opportunity to make a wage that had seniority in the plant. And I thought, that's what a movement can do. That's what I'm going to do in my life. That's how I became a movement activist.
And how did you meet Jimmy?
People are always asking me. If you read the chapter on Jimmy, someone just asked me that the other day. It starts out when people ask him that question, he grins broadly and says, "Grace got me." And I did. it was amazing. Jimmy was born in a small town in Alabama, where there are more pigs than people. And he learned to write and became a writer because the people in his community didn't read or write. And he became a scribe. And that's what decided him to become a writer. And I think that's, to me, that's what the South represented. That's kind of a way, making a way out of no way. To become a writer because others didn't write and you had to write for them. And I was just talking to a young woman today, actually, Kim is always there. And she says, you know, there was something about us in the South that we lost when we came north. It was that understanding that we could make a way out of no way. And I think that's what's going on in Detroit today. That a city that is so devastated that most people think it's the end of the world, that blacks who have been raised in the South, looked at vacant lots that had been abandoned, and where other people saw light, they saw hope. They saw an opportunity to grow our own food. They saw an opportunity to help young people who had been raised in the city and had a quick fix mentality, get a sense of patience, So this sense of the opportunity to create a whole new way of living, not only the way that we grew our food and fed ourselves, but in the way that we thought. And in Detroit, you know, mostly, if you think of Detroit, just devastation. You don't understand that there are times when human beings will look at space and see an opportunity to create a new. And that's what's going on in Detroit. That's what we talk about in the book.
I want to add a note on this, because Grace, oftentimes people want to hear more about the story of the romantic courtship of Jimmy. And she doesn't tell me much about it either. So I'm going to talk about the lessons from the political courtship. Because Grace, as she mentioned, had a PhD in philosophy, and she was a leader in a very important radical movement alongside C.L.R. James and Raya Dunayevskaya. And Jimmy Boggs is an auto worker in Detroit from the rural South who has none of that formal education. Obviously, he grew up during the era of Jim Crow. And yet, they meet politically because Grace is in a school to learn from workers like Jimmy. They had set up what they called third layer schools, where the workers are the teachers, and the so-called political leaders are the students, right? And Jimmy had such an incredible analysis and a grasp of what was going on inside the plant, the struggles, the job losses due to automation, what was happening in the consciousness of black workers and the black community in the days before the Black Power Movement in Detroit, that Grace saw that there is so much to learn from people who are at the grassroots. And that's really central. It's central to the book. It's central to all Grace's thinking, that we need to have this notion that the leadership really needs to come from the grassroots. We talk all times about we want change from the bottom up, but oftentimes that means sometimes intellectuals or party leaders see a whole bunch of millions and millions of masses that are somehow going to create, you know, be the shock troops or the foot soldiers to create change. But really what was central to in the story of Grace and Jimmy is this notion that every struggle, every organizing campaign that we're about is about unleashing the creative energies of everyone and empowering everybody to be part of a self-determining, self-governing society. So that even if we have radicals in power, it's not because they have all the good ideas and they are the leaders, but because we are the leaders we've been looking for, as Grace writes in chapter 6 of the book.
Simmons here, where she's a filmmaker and she's the daughter of Zohara Simmons, who is the first person I heard tell the story of "We are the leaders we're looking for." And you'll see her story on the last chapter of the book, chapter 6, which is entitled.
Just so you know, that phrase didn't originate in 2008.
One of the chapters of the book, Grace. One of the chapters of the book is, let's talk about Malcolm and Martin. Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, I'm very glad to be here tonight, because it was in 2007 that the speech, "Let's Talk About Malcolm and Martin," I made here in this room. And I was amazed, actually, about how little people talk about Malcolm and Martin in a serious way. I think unless we talk about them, we don't understand how much they emphasize the need not only to transform our institutions, but to transform ourselves. I mean, that concept of two-sided transformation of ourselves as well as our institutions is organic to the next American Revolution. Most people think only of the enemy as love. But we have done things over the course of our lives as Americans that we have to look at and understand, and that, as students, who was saying this earlier, was it Julio, that the primary contradiction in our country is that we have achieved a very high level of material and technological development, but we are politically and socially very underdeveloped. And that's what the next American Revolution is about, grappling with that contradiction and recognizing how fundamental it is to solve that for the sake of the planet, for the sake of all living things, for the sake of the rest of the world, and for the sake of our own souls.
Mm-hmm. So talk about them.
The first chapter is called These Are the Times to Grow Our Souls. Well, I don't know how many of you are willing to talk about souls. Probably not very many in this audience. We have a tendency to think of everything in material terms. So maybe you're afraid to use the word soul. Maybe you're talking about a thing. Well, I'm not talking about a thing. I'm talking a power within us to make choices, a power within us to create the world anew, a power within us to see possibility, to imagine possibility, to begin to go beyond what is, and to recognize, as Einstein said, and as we can see today in Japan, that the splitting of the atom changed everything but the human mind, and thus we move toward catastrophe. Mm-hmm. That's what we've been doing, and I think it's to recognize that I think the American people today have a sense of catastrophe broader and deeper than they've had for many years, and that's an opportunity to create something anew, to grow our souls, to go beyond thinking in terms of values, not only of racism, but of materialism and militarism, which have so governed our lives and which we have accepted. It's such an opportunity that we have to grasp. It's a terrible crisis, but every crisis is not only a danger, but an opportunity. Am I still talking?
Talk about your relationship with them, knowing them or not personally knowing them, and in the 60s, what they meant specifically.
Well, I think most of us think of the 60s in terms of the rights that each group fought for, and each group did fight for. But when you think of all the different groups that emerged, you see that each one was talking about redefining our identity as human beings. And now all that is coming together, and we have the opportunity, all of us, not only to redefine our identity as women or as people of color or gay or lesbian, but to redefine what it means to be a human being and to realize the enormous potential that we have wasted.
Scott, what was it like to write this book together?
Well, obviously it was just an incredible privilege. It was an incredible learning experience. And I think one of the other points I want to make is, you know, I'm a little bit younger than Grace. But actually, you know, Malcolm X and Martin Luther King were also younger than Grace as well. So she brings a lot of perspective. I was born in 1970, and you know, obviously I didn't live through, you know, the movements of the 60s the way other people did. But I think so many of us that were becoming active after the 60s, you know, the people who we look to as role models, the history that we learned from, the organizations that we aspired to be a part of, were very much shaped by the 60s, right? And I spent a long time, I think for a lot of people who lived through that generation, there was a sense that we were this close to having a revolution, right? We were this close. And I think that was a wonderful time, but I think one of the unfortunate things that a lot of people on the left have been trying to recreate that moment ever since, right?
Yes.
And we end up thinking of revolution as an event, as something we achieve, right, at what Grace calls that D-Day moment. rather than as a long process. And I thought of it that way too, as somehow you had to get enough mass force together to get back to that moment or get everybody thinking the way people were in the 60s. Not realizing, as Grace says, that reality is constantly changing. And we have to understand our own struggles based on our own reality. Learn from the past, but think about the present and the future. And I think Grace and Jimmy Boggs were able to see the 60s not just as this, you know, quintessential time that solely by itself defines the meaning of social change and revolution. They saw the 60s, because they were already elders, movement elders by the time, as something that had a beginning and an end, and that something else had to come next. And it took me a long time, because I think for so many of us who are coming of age, Generation X, Generation Y, our whole concept of struggle, for better or for worse, has been shaped by the 60s. And looking at how Grace and Jimmy were able to analyze the 60s as a time, again, of advances, but also setbacks that we had to learn from, has allowed me to break free of that concept of, oh, I didn't live through the 60s, so I'll never be a part of a movement ever again. And now recognizing, in our lifetimes, hopefully, if we can live long enough, we have a chance to create a world beyond the end of, beyond a world of American empire, a world beyond the industrial era and all of the suffering and dehumanization that caused, and a world beyond a time when America is a white majority and a racist society. Now, as Emmanuel Wallerstein tells us, the world that comes after this empire and after this global capitalist system can actually be worse. There are worse systems than what we have now, right? And we see all these forces of reaction agonizing about the decline of the American empire. But I feel much less of a sense that I missed out on everything because I wasn't born, you know, before the 60s, and that our lives are filled with all types of challenges and possibilities.
I just want to emphasize that we were able to think differently about revolution because of the rebellions of the 60s. How many people remember the rebellions? Up to that time, we had not made a distinction between rebellion and revolution. And when all hell broke loose in cities all across the country in the 60s, we began to see that we had to go beyond being angry, we had to go beyond rising up, we had to go begin thinking about what does it mean to create a new society? What are we really struggling for? And how do we expand the concepts of democracy beyond what we have? How do we begin creating a participatory democracy? How do we go beyond just jobs? How do we begin reimagining work as a way whereby we not only produce goods and services, but by you develop skills? And you're not just trying to create abundance, but you're trying to develop community. I mean, the whole idea of reimagining everything, reimagining work, reimagining education, making a paradigm shift in how we think about our relationships with one another. How do we begin being the neighbor back into the hood? But how do we do that? And how do we make the concept of love something that we can say and practice without feeling embarrassed?
Peace.
And to know that, as Sheikh Amara said, is not something that's ridiculous. When I joined the movement, it was ridiculous to think of love as the purpose of revolution.
Keep talking.
Amy wanted you to speak more about Malcolm and Martin and what we can learn from them. And I think the point about love, since love is so central to King's philosophy, is a good starting point.
You know, I said here, and I've often said, that when I encountered Martin's ideas of nonviolence in the 60s, I thought they were kind of naive. and I identified a lot more with Malcolm. But when I saw the violence break out in Detroit, particularly in the wake of the rebellions, I began to wonder whether we could combine Malcolm's militancy with Martin's nonviolence. And then it was amazing after the Martin Luther King holiday was declared, during the Reagan years, as a matter of fact, and I began speaking about Martin. I began reading him and understanding how much he understood of the concept of transformation and how much that is the essence of the modern revolution. To transform ourselves as well as institutions. To engage young people in practices by which they can transform themselves at the same time that they transform their surroundings. To think of all our culture as something very different from what it is. Our culture has emphasized things so much at the expense of our humanity. And our things have grown and our humanity has shrunk. We need to face that and understand that's the purpose of revolution, that's the process of revolution. And to feel that, and to feel that that's the growth in your soul and that's the growth in your relationships with everybody, with your family, with your neighbors, with your people you work with.
What is your assessment of these rolling rebellions from the Middle East, like Tunisia and Egypt, to Madison, Wisconsin, to Lansing, Michigan?
Well, I think we have a responsibility to carry on what the next American Revolution is in order to give them an example of what has to be done. I mean, to get rid of authoritarian government and leadership, dictatorship is only the very beginning. I think that all the problems they have to face, they're more difficult than ours because they haven't had the experience we've had, that just having jobs, just developing economically, does not solve your life problems. They have a lot to go through. They have a lot of experiences, and we can help them by giving another model of what a revolution is about.
I want to just add a point to Grace's comment about King, because we write in the book that King's vision of a revolution of values really has to be the starting point for any attempt to develop a concept of revolution in the 21st century. And I'm a historian. I study social movement history, African-American history. And even amongst historians, King is vastly underappreciated. He's put up on a pedestal as an icon, or the left has sort of recuperated King because he's made comments like the U.S., you know, my own government is the most biggest source of violence on the planet. He condemned imperialism, which he did, and that was very important. In a lot of ways, he was isolated and he was depressed and he was in many ways killed because he took this very, very radical stand that made him such a target of so many members, elements of society at the end of his life. So that King is important to know. But what Grace is talking about is King is also a philosopher of revolution. He's asking us to think about these very, very challenging questions that will lead us to envision both structural transformation and self-transformation. This is a very central concept in the book. We have to think of revolution as a two-sided concept, right? Change that comes from within and change that also happens to the structures and institutions. And how many people have heard the quote from Marx, "The philosophers have only interpreted the world. The point is to change it." Okay. So right, you know, again, I'm in academia and I'm not a champion of academia. There are a lot of things going on in the academy that I find irrelevant at worst, or at best sometimes limited. Right? But the quote from Marx should not be taken to mean you know, we only need activists. We only need to act. We don't need philosophers at all. We need to think and we need to act. And what Grace says, a revolution is a struggle to discover new truths, not to prove old truths. Okay? So right now we're in the midst, in Wisconsin, in Michigan too, we've got, our governor called himself a macho nerd, which basically means he has a very nice and friendly way of doing all the same things that Scott Walker is doing in Wisconsin. And all of these gains of the 30s and the CIO and the civil rights struggle and the workers' struggle, they're being torn to bits in this immoral pursuit of a society totally governed by money and corporations, right? And those struggles are important, but they can't end simply to maintain the contracts and the material benefits of the prior struggles. We have to look at these struggles as a challenge to think philosophically about how we're going to live in a world where all of the factories in places like Detroit have been exported to places like China, and now those in turn are creating problems for our financial system and for our environment and our ways of living and for peace and stability on the planet. These are much greater challenges than people had to face in an earlier time. They're different, they're newer, and they're things that we need to adapt to and rise to the challenge of addressing.
And we can't just defend what we had in the past. We have to recognize that what we had in the past came from the fact that we were explaining the rest of the world, and that empire is dying or dead. And we have to create a new way of caring for each other.
What is your assessment of President Obama, Grace?
Well, I don't know whether he was able to do more than he has done, but I do know that since he entered the White House, he has not been able to do what we had hoped from him. Mm-hmm. I think the White House is a trap. Mm-hmm. I think power is a trap. Mm-hmm. I think that that's why we have to depend upon the power within us and among us to create the world.
You know, when Obama was a senator running for president, and he was in the house in the backyard of a New Jersey home where he was talking to people who was running, someone asked him what he would do about the Middle East. And he repeated the story of A. Philip Randolph meeting with FDR and telling FDR about the condition of black people, the condition of working people, and FDR listening intently and then saying, I don't disagree with anything you've said, but you'll have to make me do it. That was what Obama repeated to the person who asked him about the Middle East. Do you think it is possible to make Obama do what you feel needs to be done in this country?
No, I think people quote that what FDR said and hope that there will be protests and demonstrations of a magnitude that will make Obama do what FDR did. But I think first of all, I don't think protests is what's done. I think ever since, I look back to the Battle of Seattle in 1999, we discovered that you cannot get things from this government any longer. That we have to do them ourselves. And I think that's when the world social forum began. We began talking about how another world is necessary, another world is possible, and we began thinking of how we could create it ourselves. It's a very different time. If we keep on thinking that the protest will make Obama do the things we are thinking outside the time that we are at the clock, on the clock of the world. This in the 30s, much of what we achieved was achieved because Roosevelt was going to war, and much of what we've enjoyed since World War II has been at the expense of all the people that were killed during that war. Has been because the United States has been the dominant economic force in the world, and we no longer are. I mean, this is not a time for protest. this is a time for creating things ourselves. Mm. And we are lucky that the Detroit things were so bad that we have to begin doing it.
You talked about reconsidering Martin Luther King. What about Malcolm X and what he did and who he was and what you were doing while he was doing what he was doing?
Well, you know, a new book has just been published, and I've just started reading it by
Manning
Merrill. I happen to be very critical of Manning.
Because?
Well, first of all, I don't like the title, The Reinvention of Malcolm. Because where Manning starts is that there are two characters in black community, tricksters and ministers. And the idea that the title, Reinventions of Malcolm, suggests that Malcolm was constantly reinventing himself as a trickster. Whereas as you start reading the book and as you follow Malcolm's life, you realize how he is constantly learning, constantly transforming himself, how much he was a model of transformation. And some years ago, Maribel wrote an article on there are no longer two tendencies in the black movement, no longer just separation or integration, but there's transformation. And this concept of transformation was so shallow, it really, really helped me. I've been very critically asking what Cyrus, why I'm so critical of him.
Manning's book is Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention. I wish we could have him sitting here debating you.
Well, I think if folks will look back, I think one of the most glaring mistakes that Manning made, not only what he wrote, but what he did, was in 1998 he called for the Black Radical Congress. Folks will remember that. And they convened in Chicago in June 1998. Well, I was asked by Bob Lucas, who led the March into Cicero in 1966, what I thought of Black Radical Congress. And I wrote an article, which was published, in which I said that you cannot create a new movement, which is what the Black Radical Congress is supposed to do, unless you understand the old. And there was nothing in the call for the Black Radical Congress which was an assessment of the Black Panther Party or of Martin Luther King's call for a revolution of values, which were two of the most important developments that took place in the Black movement in the period prior to the Black Panther Congress. And you can, that's an absence of a sense of history, I think, is what has been so debilitating to our movements, that we have not thought enough about how people have struggled, and we have not thought enough about the difference between people who have struggled.
You gotta teach!
I want to add something here, because it took me a long time to appreciate two points, a lot of things, you know, because Grace has a lot of ideas, and it takes a long time to struggle to understand the full meaning of them. But I want to focus on two. First, and this came up already from Janza, that we need to distinguish between a rebellion and a revolution. That was one of the first things she told me. I think I was driving her back from the airport. And she said that was one of the most important things. And I never fully understood that until I did more reading, and particularly until I moved to Detroit. Because Detroit really represented, in so many ways, the height of rebellion and opposition to American racism and empire and capitalist domination. And Detroiters suffered tremendously because of it. There was massive capital flight, massive repression there to this day. I mean, Detroit doesn't even have the right, Detroiters don't even have the right really to govern themselves anymore. There's been a law passed in Michigan that says the governor can appoint an emergency financial manager who can basically tear up any contract he wants, who can usurp the role of elected officials. It's already happened to our school system. They're talking now about class sizes being up to 60 students per class next year. And we're talking about a city in which half the schools have already been closed. You've got kids who went to a different school for 9th, 10th, and 11th grade, and now the school's going to close, and they have to go to a different school for 12th grade. Right? So we've already lost all that, and now we've lost even just that basic semblance of representative democracy. Right? And it means, therefore, that we simply cannot demand more things from the government if we just were more disciplined and more powerful and had more bodies, that we could restore some sense of justice. It means we have to anticipate a whole new way of living, a whole new, you know, for those of you that are still Marxists, a whole new mode of production.
A whole new way of education.
And that's what that's how revolution challenges us to be creative. To be creative in the sense of imaginative and the creative in the sense of generative. That's what we talk about in chapter 2. We have to think of revolution as a new beginning. And once I was able to grasp that, I began to appreciate Grace's critique of the left. Okay, because her critique of leftists and radicals is not because, you know, she wants to validate, you know, the right wing or the neocons. Her point is that movements leap forward not just because of opposition to all the things that are wrong with the world. Movements leap forward because we see the limits and the crises and the contradictions within our own thinking and within our own movements. And that's what she's talking about when she's saying, if we want to have a new radical movement, we need to be critical about the tendencies within our own movements that have prevented us from making that leap forward that we need to. So when she reads Marx and Lenin, that's what she's looking for. When she looks at history, she's looking at how do we understand where we are on the path towards new breakthroughs, not where we are in this endless battle of right versus left. Because that battle is going to go on for a long time. There are a lot of right-wing reactionary forces in this country who are against immigration, who are against people of color, who are against limousine liberals, who are against Obama because they think he's not born in this country. That nonsense is going to get stronger and stronger because we're moving more and more away from that old vision of the American dream. But if we keep fighting those battles and we only stop there, we'll never be able to create a new concept of revolution that we need to get beyond this endless dichotomy between an old version of the left and an old version of the right.
Grace, what frightens you the most now, and what gives you the most hope?
Well, I'm not frightened. I think there is an awakening beginning to take place, and I think we need to recognize it, welcome it, and expand it. And I think that it helps to do that, because if you're frightened, or if you only see the negative, and you don't see the negative as an opportunity to move toward a new positive, you make yourself powerless. I mean, it has a lot to do with what Julian told me earlier from Hegel. You know, Hegel was Martin Luther King's favorite philosopher. Most people don't know that. But I think, I don't think actually that until toward the end of his life that King really understood dialectics. He was very young. I only began to understand it very well myself, I think, as I grew older. I think that the opportunity that the negative creates for us and the challenge that it creates for us to think anew, to expand our imagination, to understand how humanity has been evolving, not only anatomically, not only physiologically, but in terms of what means become a human being. That's the basic question of philosophy, by the way. What does it mean to be human? And that's where we are now. We're asking that question and grappling with it.
I want to do a poll. How many people in this room, raise your hand if you've been part of an activist group? How many people have been part of an activist group or campaign or movement that splintered or fell apart? Okay, this is normal. This happens to all of us. Grace says it happens more in New York because there's so many of you. You always think you can split off and form another group. And she was part of a lot of those splinter groups in New York. And I think there was a time, going back to growing up in the aftermath of the 60s, where I felt, boy, if those groups from the 60s fall apart, you know, the last ones were clinging to dear life when I was in college, then that's it. We'll never have another chance to move forward. And or you could just be in any kind of group where people get dejected, where people burn out, where people get depressed. This happens all the time. So when we talk about sustainable activism, there's an obvious meaning that says, look, if we don't develop a sustainable way of living, I will say I'm scared. Maybe it's because I have a small child. I'm scared about what kind of world, even when my child is a relatively young adult, you know, in her 30s, 40s, 50s, what kind of world she will live in, given all that's happening with these natural catastrophes and human-made catastrophes.
Yeah.
So I felt that sense. At the same time, though, what I get from Grace is that understanding is that these contradictions always arise, because the things that once united us can be sources of division when conditions change. So it's very easy to be united when Bush was president, because, you know, I mean, suddenly I was on the same page as Al Gore on so many questions, you know? I never voted for Al Gore, but vice president, president, anything, you know? And suddenly I was like, wow, Al Gore's speaking out against the war. And then, you know, Bush was no longer in power, and all these questions of what do you actually do with this government that's been such a mess for so long, and this society and this culture, what do you actually do with it? That split us in so many different ways. And now we have to struggle to understand that every crisis is a result of change and history moving forward in a way that it'll never turn back, and that we have to take these crises as a challenge to think more creatively, or as Grace says, think more dialectically. Right? Think more. That is really Grace's favorite phrase among our many, many favorite phrases. Think dialectically.
I wonder how many people realize that Martin's most famous speech, the Revolution of Values speech, the anti-break the silence, anti-Vietnam speech, only took place because of his disappointment, not destroyed, the challenge by the rebellion in Watts in 1965. In 1965, King was in the White House celebrating the signing of the Voting Rights Act, which had been won through the struggle in Selma. And all hell broke loose in Watts. And King went to Watts, and the young people there he found had never heard of him. And they were feeling very excited because by rising up, they had scared the hell out of the authorities. And they asked him why they should be nonviolent in this country when the United States was so violent overseas. And that shook him up. You know, he could have become disappointed, he could have become despairing, he could have given up hope, but that experience made him think more deeply. And I think that's how we have to deal with reality. That's how we have to struggle. Over and over again, as we go out and do things, they don't always work. Or they work so well that you split. I mean, someone goes one way and so others go another way. But every life is all like that. I mean, it's one struggle after another, and learning from each one.
So I'm sorry, just the second then definition of sustainable activism. Because people always ask, Grace, how have you sustained your activism for so long? I think there are a lot of lessons there. That we look at adversity and hardship, the labor, the suffering, the patience of the negative, as a challenge to us, as an opportunity to grow. Every crisis is an opportunity. And so when we think about what's going to sustain a movement or an organization, it's not so much, you know, do we have enough money? Do we have enough people? Because movements can get a lot of people and a lot of money in a short period of time and then disappear. I was just reading about this flip camera company was like the best-selling camera within like a year of its creation or 2 years, and now it just went out of business, you know,
really?
within a four-year life cycle. Right? So change can happen very quickly. It doesn't necessarily matter as to how much money or numbers you have. The question is, what are the values and principles and relations at the core of any movement, right? We spend so much time struggling to think, do we have the right slogans, or as leftists say, do we have the right line? Do we have the right venue? Do we have the right leaders? Are the leaders making the right speeches? If only Obama would make a better speech or do it in front of the right audience, we think, check others to do it. And those things do make a difference, you know? But what really matters in terms of sustaining a movement is, are we thinking dialectically? Are we putting the emphasis on new creative energies? Are we thinking about the relationships that we're developing with each other? Are we prioritizing the values that we think embody the next revolution? These are the things, and organizations even come and go. States and nations come and go. Mm. But these aspects of human development can outlast those organizations and movements and nations and states.
What do you think of what will happen to unions now with this hyper-focus of Scott Walker, of all of these governors, Republican, but also Democrat, I mean, right here in New York?
Well, I think the unions will have to change. I think that the whole idea that you can only that you have to defend jobs at a time when jobs are indefensible, when they are shrinking, is an incorrect premise for building an organization. Yes. I think unions have the potential, and I hope to help them do that. I were trying to do that in Detroit. I think they're at a stage in human history where we have to reimagine what work is for, what the essence of work is. That we have thought too much, except the idea that labor, which is a very recent development, only a few hundred years old, that labor, the people have always labored for pay. That only began with capitalism a few hundred years ago. Before that, people worked to produce goods and resources, to work together with other people, to develop skills, not by to get paid by the hour. And we have come to the end of that. Mm-hmm. And we've got to think, reimagine work. We're organizing a conference in the fall, which we're calling Reimagining Work. And we're still trying to think about that. You know, I believe that we are going to accept that despite the huge abundance that mass production has created, it has done that at the expense of our humanity. As Marx said, the payment high or low, the fragmentation of the human being has taken place with mass production. And as Gandhi said, that if we have mass production, we'll end up at the point where we can't distinguish between our needs and our wants.
Yeah.
And that's where we are. We have reached a point where we have to think, face with sober senses, as Marx says, our conditions of life and our relations with our kind. It's a very, it's a fantastic period.
Yeah.
in the history of humanity. You know, I've clarified and I'm talking about it begins, it's in the Communist Manifesto, written when Marx was a very young man. It begins with constant revolutions of technology distinguished boudoir epoch from all previous epochs, and it ends up with all that is solid melts into air, all that is sacred is profane, and man is placed with solar sources, his relations with his conditions of life, his relations with the sky. And that's where we are. And we have to respond with solar senses and know that we have the capacity to respond that way.
I want to reinforce that with a very short quote from the book, and then I'll give Grace the last word, and I know she wants to sign books, and people have been waiting for her to do that. So this is from chapter 2 on the concept of revolution as a new beginning, and here Grace is talking about how she and C.L.R. James and others in the Johnson Forest Tendency read Marx in a very different way than most others on the left and other radicals were doing at the time, and probably in many ways still are. She says, when you read Marx, or in parentheses, or Jesus, this way, beyond thinking about materialism and consumerism, you come to see that real wealth is not material wealth, and real poverty is not just the lack of food, shelter, and clothing. Real poverty is the belief that the purpose of life is acquiring wealth and owning things. Real wealth is not the possession of property, but the recognition that our deepest need as human beings is to keep developing our natural and acquired powers to relate to other human beings.
That's right.
Okay. So Grace talks about, you know, we can and hopefully we'll have bigger protests against all of the destruction that's going on. But until we change this collective mindset, right, about what is real poverty and what is real wealth, all of these protests won't add up to the type of transformation of ourselves and our structures that will define this two-sided revolution.
And for those of you who love Marx, and there are many things in Marx that I love, that idea of real poverty and real wealth comes from his early philosophical manuscripts written in 1843 to 1844 and called Economic Philosophical Manuscripts.
Final words, Grace, before you sign books for me.
Well, I would admit this, and one thing that I say very often, and I'd like to leave with you, is that despite the attempts of this power structure to commodify us and all our human relations, we must embrace the conviction that we have the power within us to create the world anew.